well, perhaps we should make a start and come in as they will. Well, I'm very pleased indeed to introduce Sarah Shaw from the university here, who's an expert in Buddhist meditation, who's done this wonderful book, Buddhist Meditation Anthology of Texts, with Routledge, which I'd highly recommend, who has done a great service, I think, with this book in bringing together different texts about meditation in Buddhism, because Buddhism is so often associated with meditation, but so often people know so little about it. and today, I've booked her into this series on comparative mysticism, which I'm sure she will respond to creatively. So, without more ado, I hand you over to Sarah. Thank you.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for inviting me. It's a great credit to Hindu traditions that you're always sure of a very warm welcome whenever you come here. The title of the series exercised an immediate appeal for me, which I'll discuss a little. It was rather amusing that, as Gavin and I realised at about the same time, the word mysticism appears not at all in any literature about my talk. So, as the local and apparently non-mystical speaker, it is perhaps particularly incumbent on me to discuss the use of the term which describes this series, mysticism. And I very much hope at the end, when I have discussed some aspects of early Buddhist practice that I think may be designated by that category, that we can have some discussion about this wonderfully elusive and mysterious term, as well as some discussion of the nature of the experiences and insights with which it's usually associated. So at the outset, I'd like to explore some associations of the word mystical. I am not a theologian, I'm more of a text literary person, so I would be inept in trying to use the language. But I feel that in a subject like this, close examination of our popular cultural interpretations, and hence perhaps our usual and even unconscious assumptions, is not only useful but crucial. It seems to me that we are in such cases often governed by patterns of usage, association, and tides in academic and popular tastes. Words we apply in our common vocabulary are often dragged out of fashion by various unidentified currents. But it is quite important and illuminating for academics and practitioners to explore quite why this is happening. I have seen whole traditions damned in books of comparative religions by the word mere. Now, it usually goes before devotion, chanting. I actually made a list while I was working on it of all the activities called mere or just. I think the best one was one I found in a Korean Journal of Buddhist Studies last year. In this, a particular kind of chanting was only merely conducted by women in their 50s. So I thought, well, but it is interesting to me to look at words that we use quite, and they're not the academic terms necessarily, but it's the kind of the clusters around them. In this regard, I realised, and this is an entirely personal observation, that I was one of the population who would walk past any poster, book, or event prefaced with the word mystery, mysterious, mystical, and mysticism, and immediately assume that there was something interesting and perhaps even inherently truthful about it. Detective and adventure mysteries, the mystery tour, and of course in a religious context, mystical illumination, suggest a path is being found through the intricate, the obscure, the concealed, and the unmanifest, and that we are going to be guided through it. We're going to have a Mr. Gogus, to guide us through it so that some secret may be discovered and harmony restored in the world. And I felt this applied to most entities involving the word mystery in them, that we would have a guide who would show us through these strange events and then bring order back into chaos. This sense of ehi pasiko, come and see, is certainly part of the Buddhist path to some, but I realise this probably placed me within a certain type of temperamental disposition described in Buddhist texts. So I thought of another kind of temperament, and again I know this only from anecdotal experience, will walk past any such poster or advertisement and be alerted only by one which they would ignore the ones with any mist word in, and be alerted only by one which contains the following words: factually proven, scientific, laboratory tested, realistic, often accompanied by the reassurance that the product, talk or genre will demystify us in our of our apprehensions and be facts-based, applicable and grounded in something quite romantically called everyday life. So a pattern is found in events through the careful recording and revealing of something which has been tested and approved at an empirical level, and through some sort of accredited and approved consensus of criteria susceptible to common validation. I was hesitant to assign religious traditions to either of these because I felt that it was something more of a temperamental disposition, but I think that's perhaps something we can discuss. I think that the people who prefer things to be scientific perceive sometimes the non-rational as irrational. And of course it's not quite the same thing. It seems to me that both apprehensions have substantial foundation, and as may be seen from my comparison, both have their inherent paradoxes. Many, if not all, fact-based scientists acknowledge that metaphoric and symbolic language must be employed to describe events that seem to accord to patterns unfamiliar to known paradigms, as, for instance, Dennis Noble does in his work on the genetic code. He's entitled The Music of Life. Conversely, in my experience, those working on texts that could be termed mystical in both an academic and practice-based context insist on clear terminology, accurate observation, and an avoidance of any inaccuracy in the use of language, whether symbolic or literal. This problem seemed to me to lie at the heart of any discussion of the term mysticism, both in an academic and a popular context. It was reinforced by a consultation with the OED, which provides, I think, a very useful litmus guide to a certain sense of received usage, and I'd like to suggest at the end of this series we send in a new series of definitions for mysticism, having looked at it. The OED does insist on a Christian element as its primary definition of the word mystical, initially associating the term with the Christian sacrament, which of course excludes many traditions that contain elements they would regard as mystical, such as Judaism and Sufism. It does, however, list other more inclusive definitions, that the mystical is allegorical or symbolical, and the definition describes other attributes usually associated with the term, that it refers to phenomena having an unknown or unseen origin, character, effect or influence, that are connected with mystical practices, and again, very interestingly, secret, unavowed or concealed. Its definition of mysticism itself is more broad. After saying that it relates to activities associated with the adjective mystical, it says, mysticism is the belief in the possibility of union with the divine nature by means of ecstatic contemplation. Reliance on spiritual intuition or exalted feeling as a means of acquiring knowledge of mysteries inaccessible to intellectual apprehension. But it then gives the secondary pejorative meaning as a term of reproach. And this is listed under two subcategories. The first implies self-delusion or dreamy confusion of thought. Hence the term is applied to any religious belief to which these evil qualities are imputed. The second is that it is sometimes applied to philosophical or scientific theories alleged to involve the assumption of occult qualities or mysterious agencies of which no rational account can be given. And this is put under term of reproach rather than any other category. So I felt there was quite a great deal of information there which I felt was led to the heart of the problem, because for some the word mystical has associations which render it some way suspect, over-subjective or ill-founded, and for others it's just a straightforwardly accurate term describing an area of experience not easily susceptible to explanation. And that last term of reproach would actually have been quite happily sitting in another category as being something positive by that sort of person. So it was, I thought that was rather interesting. I did have an unverifiable suspicion that the entirely non-cognate word mist played an odd nirukti in the modern mind, and perhaps had something to do with this. Nirukti is a little verbal pun where you, in Indian thought, where you find similarities between words which aren't apparently related to one another. For those to whom mystery, mysterious and mystique are attractive, it is the acknowledgement of an unknown, a mist or in cloud, embedded in any understanding of the human relationship with what may be regarded as numinous, revelatory or transcendent. The cloud of unknowing seems to encapsulate this kind of intimation, whereas for others such terminology is suspect because there is more a sense of something being revealed or overt or exoteric even. This did make me consider, and I'm sorry to look at the term so much, but it did interest me a great deal from a purely cultural point of view as a word. So I looked at etymology. Now, derivation is not the same as modern application, but I think the ancient Greeks do serve a useful purpose in this regard, because they can't be accused of subscribing to any of the major world religions, though they have clearly left their mark on much and many of the Abrahamic traditions in various kinds of ways. But I thought it was quite interesting to go to the Greek roots. And of course the word mysticism comes from a very simple Greek verb, muein, to shut one's eyes or one's mouth. I actually liked this level and of interpretation. It has an association with the mysteries and with a guide who will take you through a series of events in which you'll be initiated. And it then becomes associated with keeping a secret, that if you keep your mouth shut, you will thereby keep a secret. So that is part of the earliest level of association with the term. And oddly enough, out of all the features I've discussed, I found this the most helpful in a Buddhist context, because I've written a book on Buddhist meditation, and people talk about Buddhist meditation, but in fact there isn't a word in the Pali text that corresponds exactly to meditation. The word that's usually used, bhavana, means to make much of or to cause to become. And it refers to a series of activities which bring into being the path in all aspects. So if we help somebody struggling in the road, they've fallen over, that will be bhavana. If somebody's generous, that will also be bhavana. It will be bringing into being the qualities necessary for the path. It includes meditation as one aspect of that. So in many ways, the distinction between those activities that could be regarded as bhavana and which cover features of the Eightfold Path, like right livelihood, right speech, and right action, are mostly conducted with one's eyes open, whether literally or metaphorically, whereas the activity which is associated with concentration or meditation is in fact usually conducted with the eyes shut. Now, I thought out of curiosity it would be very interesting to look in the early literature and see the extent to which the enjoinder is given. And I hope this doesn't seem too literal, but I thought it would actually be very interesting to see when people are actually told to shut their eyes in a meditation and to stop speaking, if you know. So I did have a look through the text, and it's quite rare, though people often talk about emerging from meditation in the verses of the monks written after the Buddha's death, and they say their eyes are opened, meaning that they've had a revelatory experience, which it implies, though, that has taken place where the eyes are shut. For most of the activities, though, the only meditation practice I could find that actually includes the enjoinder to shut the eyes is one I'll discuss called the kasana practice. And it says to shut the eyes because the first part you have to have your eyes open, as I will explain. But it then says that you have to look at the image of what you have seen in your eyes, mind's eye. The other aspect of speech, obviously, we can take on all sorts of levels, and in Buddhism there is the aspect of the noble Aryan silence, which is considered very praiseworthy. There is also guarding speech in terms of not making, as one of the many enjoinders under right speech, there are things like not making frivolous, unkind speech, not speaking harshly, not dividing one person from another, not belittling others or despising them in your speech. And the active part of this is called, the Patisampadamagga describes as embracing right speech, is actually embracing, and it looks to find a way of not undermining or belittling. So there are various aspects of speech in that way. There are also a number of enjoinders in the canon for monks to be silent at certain stages, say when they're practicing together, and there are a few suttas where that is suggested. When we get to the techniques of meditation, which I will talk a little bit about, it's slightly it's an interesting contradiction that actually some meditations involve a kind of jalapa, an internal murmuring, or which is intended to suspend discursive thought through the repetition of syllables or words, which will allow the mind to be free from the usual associative thinking, vichara. And it will, if you like, they talk about the purification of vichara, of making vichara almost like separating it from all the random thoughts that we normally have, and allowing it to be free in meditation. The other aspect of speech is the area where speech is stilled, which is in the second of the meditations I'm going to describe, and that is where thinking about things is supposed to stop. And this is described as internal speech is stilled. So it's, I think in the Christian tradition this could be related to St. Rich's differentiation between contemplation and meditation, because he says that contemplation is associated with discursive thought, and I think the early meditations, if you look at them hierarchically in Buddhism, are associated with discursive thought, but that is after a while dropped. So it's quite interesting to look at the word and see it in that way, and I actually rather liked the word mystical after that in terms of its precision in describing activities which the Buddhists often loosely term bhavana, which this term separates and associates more with meditation and sitting practice. And I'll perhaps talk a little bit about the secrecy aspect afterwards, because that's obviously a difficult area. Now, I will just read a little bit from the Great Sutta on meditation, and I personally thought there were certain areas which we discussed a little bit last week that were associated with mystical practice and this kind of meditative practice, samadhi-based practice, which I think the traditions possibly have in common, and I thought that procedures and techniques were quite an interesting way of looking at parallels between traditions rather than hurtling into, to go straight to doctrine. And the first one is that there's usually some sort of restraint associated with mystical experience, that we discussed this last week. We talk about guarding of the sense doors in Buddhism. This can be guarding of speech too. And some sort of sense in which the senses need to be left behind, but not necessarily rejected. And the Buddhist tradition is quite careful not to encourage rejection of the senses. But it did strike me that some traditions were sometimes prepared to use systems like fasting or self-mortification to arouse a different kind of state, which is actively discouraged in Buddhism. But that's perhaps just a particularity to Buddhism. The other aspect, which I think it needs stressing because it is often forgotten in books on Buddhist meditation today, and not only actually forgotten but rather de-emphasized, is that it's usual to take refuge at the beginning of a meditation practice. And there are stories that this guards people from demons in the outside world and in the internal world. But it's where you pay homage to the Buddha, the teaching, and those who followed the path. And all the commentaries stress this throughout, at the beginning of their discussions of concentration. They say you must arouse this. And it isn't, I think, the popular criticism of this now, because obviously there are a lot of books on Buddhist meditation, say, don't worry, you don't have to worry about the religious aspects. You don't have to do the chanting. But I think if you read the commentaries carefully, it isn't, well, they obviously wouldn't phrase it in those terms, but it's such activities are ways of, they all say, of arousing cheerfulness and confidence, ensuring that you sleep at night and that you're not frightened. So they're quite simple protectives at the beginning of a meditation, and it's not, I think it's often viewed with some suspicion in modern contexts. I don't know whether this is found in Buddhist, in Hindu traditions, but certainly in Buddhist traditions. This whole area, which is actually greatly stressed within the texts, tends to be a bit of an embarrassment, I think, to some Westerners. But that's just an interesting observation, and I don't know what one could do about this from an academic point of view. So the third aspect is you need an object of meditation. Now, in Buddhist meditation, there are two kinds of practice. One is for the arousing of calm, and one's for the arousing of insight. Normally speaking, practices involving calm of the mind are taught before insight ones, but that needs to be very heavily qualified by modern practice since the 19th century. In a lot of movements from Burma have stressed insight practice and not the calm so much. Early texts state quite categorically in numerous places that both are needed. And I personally can't subscribe to an argument that has been promulgated a little bit in the last century or so that the samatha elements are later or not necessary. I don't think that's justified by any reading of the text. They do date from the earliest level of the text, this idea of the need for calm. And what you do is you take an object and you can view it for a number of characteristics. So if we look at, say, the yellow in the flowers there, we can see that it's... actually, that's rather a good one because it's beginning to fade a bit. So that's just very good. That it's a beautiful colour. And that colour is then taken as the basis of a calm meditation. Now, if we were going to conduct an insight practice, we would look at the flowers and notice how they are fading and realise that that aspect of impermanence is present in ourselves as well. And in fact, there are many commentarial stories of somebody doing just that sort of practice. There's a story about a boy who can't get anywhere with his meditation practice, so he's told to look at some golden flowers, and he immediately attains jhana, the state of ecstatic absorption on the object. And then afterwards he said, but don't become, he's told, you mustn't become too attached to it, and he has to look at them and think of them as fading away and withering. There are 40 meditation objects said to produce calm, and I'll just list them. They are in my book and they're in most books, but I'll just go through them in groups really very briefly. The one I've just mentioned would have been what's called a yellow kasina. Actually, I will write that up, shall I? Kasana. And it's from the word Sanskrit word entire. Kasana. It's a calm meditation device. And it's chosen because it's beautiful. And this is an assumption that must be stressed about Buddhist apprehensions of the world. The reason why Buddhism puts so much emphasis on non-attachment is because the world is so beautiful and it is likely to arouse attachment. I do think that needs to be stressed, actually, because people sometimes think it's a kind of detached view of the world, and that is not the case. The chitta at the heart of human experience and in all our sense objects is, and in the resultant effects in the sensory objects we see in the world, is beautiful. We're looking at beautiful objects all the time, and our minds are inherently predisposed towards a radiance which has given us a human rebirth. So this is a very positive attitude, and I think it does need to be stressed that this object is actually beautiful, and that is any of the four elements and the four basic colours, yellow, blue, white and red. Ancient India didn't have very strong colour differentiation in terms of a vocabulary of colour. And space and consciousness. And all these objects are beautiful ones. Now, in order that the mind doesn't plunge into something without alertness, the meditator is encouraged to say the word associated with that object in his mind. So, say if it's yellow, you would say yellow, yellow, yellow. When you have a strong apprehension of that object, you then shut your eyes, repeat this word yellow, yellow, which is not a mantra in the sense that it contains the properties of the object. It's been that yellowness does not inhere in the word yellow. And after a while, an image of yellowness will arise in the mind's eye, and while keeping as the object of mindfulness that internal jalapa, repetition, you will then develop the qualities necessary to enter the first jhana. And this, I don't know how much people know about Buddhism, but this is accompanied by vitaka, vichara, initial and sustained thought, joy, happiness, and ekagata, gone to oneness. It's an immensely unificatory experience, and that is how it is described. I was going to read you some, but I'll just go through the other meditation object first, and then just read you a little bit about the experience of the jhana. The other ten are, the next ten are foul objects, and this is where the Buddhists got a terrible reputation for visiting cemeteries and charnel grounds, because you take a body in various stages of decomposition, and you, again, just use this word. Interestingly, it's also a practice intended to arouse calm. But there are all sorts of protectives and safeguards within the way this practice is taught. You have to go with somebody, you have to tell somebody that you've gone to practice this. If anybody asks you the way or the time of the day, you must answer them, which I thought was quite... So there are all these correctives to prevent people becoming scared in any way, really. The other meditation objects are concerned with the Brahma Viharas of loving kindness, sympathetic joy, compassion, and equanimity. And the formless realms, where the mind examines itself, and where feeling has, in a sense, been emerged from. The first jhanas are very ecstatic, but then that ecstasy is calmed to a kind of peacefulness or stillness. That's certainly evident in the texts. And the other meditation objects are things like food, watching food going out of the body, and watching the four elements. So there are a number of different kinds of objects, but all of them have these basic procedures, which I was going to read, and I'll read you them now. So, this is from the Samanyapala Sutta, where a monk is told how to be, a king is told how to live in a meditative life. And the first thing he must do is be a gatekeeper for the faculties of sense. Seeing a visible object with the eye, he does not grasp at the appearance, nor does he grasp at the various details. So harmful, unskillful states, such as longing, discontent would assail him if he were to abide without restraint with regard to the eye faculty. He practices restraint, guards the eye faculty, and achieves restraint over the eye faculty, and it goes through each one of the senses. So there's a kind of the restraint sense. Then he starts to develop mindfulness, alertness, and clear comprehension. He acts with mindfulness and clear comprehension when walking backwards and forwards, in looking ahead or behind, bending, stretching, wearing his outer and inner robe, carrying his bowl, eating and drinking, chewing and swallowing, defecating and urinating, walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent. And that is how he is mindful and clearly comprehending. He should be content. He is content with what he has, with the robe to cover his body and his alms food to fill his stomach. Wherever he goes, he takes just these with him, just as a bird carries his wings as his only burden when he goes into flight. So contentment is important. Then he finds a place of seclusion, which is interesting because I think that is another aspect of mystical or meditative experience, the idea of a secluded place. The roots of a forest tree, a mountain cave or a mountain cleft, a charnel ground, a jungle thicket or a heap of straw in the open air. After he's returned from the alms round and eaten his food, he sits, folding his legs in a cross-legged position, makes his body straight, and sets up mindfulness before him. He purifies his mind of longing, so he has to get rid of the five hindrances first. He abandons ill will and hatred. With his mind purified of ill will and hatred and compassionate, wishing for the welfare of all sentient beings, he purifies the mind of ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, he perceives light, is mindful and clearly comprehending, and he purifies the mind of sloth and torpor. This is through the perception of light. Abandoning restlessness and worry, he abides in calm, and with a mind made inwardly peaceful, purifies his mind of restlessness and worry. Abandoning doubt, he abides having crossed over doubt, and without being troubled about what is or is not wholesome, he purifies his mind of doubt. And each one of these hindrances is compared to, say, being imprisoned or captured or ill, and then you're free from them in meditation. So there's that feature which I think is common to many traditions of preparing the mind. And then when he is free from them all, there's a series that comes up again and again in meditative texts. When he sees these five hindrances have been abandoned in him, gladness arises. In the one who is glad, joy arises. The body of the one who is joyful becomes tranquil. The one who is happy concentrates the mind. This monk, quite secluded from sense desires, unskillful states, enters and abides in the first jhana. This is the meditation, which is accompanied by initial thought and sustained thought, filled with a joy and happiness born of seclusion. He pervades, drenches, saturates, and suffuses this very body with the joy and happiness born of seclusion, and there is no place in his entire body that is not suffused with this joy and happiness. Suppose a skilled bathman or his assistant were to sprinkle powdered soap into a metal dish, splash water all around it, and knead it into a soap ball, so that the ball of soap would be taken up, permeated, and steeped in moisture, inside and outside, yet would not trickle. In the same way, a monk pervades, drenches, saturates, and suffuses this very body with the joy and happiness born of seclusion, and there is no place in his entire body that is not suffused with joy and happiness. This great king is a visible fruit of recluseship, more excellent and choice than any that have gone before. So that's really the basis for the Buddhist meditative system. And after that, there are very beautiful images for the other jhanas. I'm not sure if you would call them mystical in their language, and perhaps we can discuss that later. Because it isn't, they are not particularly associated with anything that is hidden at this stage in the teaching. But perhaps we can discuss that more at the end. But the aspect of feeling is purified through these jhanas, so that in the fourth jhana, all joy and happiness is dropped, and the mind becomes very clear. And this is when there is description of going into the psychic powers or the formless meditations or insight. In recent years, I think the psychic powers have understandably been a bit viewed with suspicion, but they are there in the early texts. Things like being able to recollect your own past lives, to travel through the air, to turn one body into many. They're actually throughout the early texts. So clearly, I think in early Buddhist times, it was just considered de rigueur to show off your psychic powers. If you read the text, it's true of Indian texts as well of this time, that if there's a great sage, it's obligatory to show that you can create so many world mountain ranges or cross over to Sri Lanka in 5 seconds or something through the air. And certainly this is the kind of magical thing that's described in early texts. And so for the Buddha not to have participated in them would have been, would have compromised his reputation. But he does view them with caution, and perhaps there is an element of mysticism in his. He says that they should only be used where appropriate. And in fact, in the text, he very often goes to teach somebody by appearing before them using his psychic powers and will give teaching. And that's an appropriate use. they're kind of outflows from the meditation. So I don't know where this leaves us in terms of whether these can be described as mystical. I said there's a restraint involved. There's an orientation, the refuge. There's an object taken up. The eradication of hindrances, which I think is common to many mystical and meditative practices. And the active cultivation of factors for meditation. And then in Buddhist tradition, there is also an enjoinder to remember afterwards what you have done so that you're free. And to open the eyes. And indeed, enlightenment is often described as the eyes being opened, and I think this is where this image I was looking at of closing and shutting the eyes is so interesting in Buddhism, because the meditations are conducted with the eyes shut, but the insight seems to be of a nature that is described as the eyes opening. Now, clearly there are all sorts of accretions of symbolism here, but I thought it was quite a good term in the end, the term mystical, to describe Buddhist meditative experience, because on the basis of the calm that such experiences produces, then insight can be aroused. Now, I think I haven't gone into all of William James's characteristics, but I think what would be more interesting would be if you looked at some Buddhist texts and told me whether you thought they were missed. Have we got time?
Mm-hmm. We do time.
Yes, oh good. I think that was, there were some other features. Perhaps shall I just say a little bit about William James? In fact, that would be helpful as a way of looking at the at the text we're going to explore a bit. I don't know how skilled you all are in Jamesian theology, but he basically classified meditative experience, mystical experience, under 4 categories. The first one was ineffability. And he said, just like a musician can't explain why music is wonderful, or an artist can't explain why art is wonderful. So what he calls a negative denoter is the only recourse to which a mystic has when he's trying to describe his experience. And I think this is certainly true of all Indian texts, this sense of ineffability. And I think it is there less so in Buddhist texts, but it is certainly present. I've always had real problems with this, because I think that anything is ineffable. If you eat an apple, you will never, ever explain to anybody what an apple tastes like. So I've always had a problem with that initial category, but I do realise it's an important one. And within the Buddhist tradition, there is less of an emphasis on, perhaps, what we would call mystical language, but we can look at that. The Buddha is supposed to teach with the open hand. But I would like people to look at some texts and in a way tell me whether you think they are or not. The second quality he describes, as William James describes as essential, is that it's noetic, that it will... They are described as states of knowledge as well as feeling. Now, this is true of jhana, the Buddhist meditation state. It has to be accompanied by wisdom and mindfulness in order to be fully jhana, and wrong jhana is described, so that there are wrong states, wrong concentration states, without wisdom and alertness. Having said that, within Buddhism there are some enjoinders not to take any meditative state as the truth unless you first checked with your meditation teacher. Because sometimes, apparently in the text, people would achieve a formless realm, a state of great bliss, infinite space, say, beyond bliss even, so peaceful it's beyond bliss, and think that they had attained their goal. So it's very important to, and in fact it's only just one stage in the path, so that it's very important to consult with a meditation teacher in both in traditional Buddhism, in the commentaries and in the texts, this is constantly enjoined, but also in modern practice, to check that your experiences, which you think are absolutely it, they might not be. Conversely, you might be dismissing something that's actually very, very useful. Yeah.
Oh, sorry to
interrupt. No, do.
How is this checking going on? You tell the experience then.
Yes, I was. That's something I'll mention just at the end, yeah. So the noetic quality, the knowing quality of the experience, which I think is present in Buddhist jhana, but is only really fully developed at the moment of path, where you do know. That's a real knowledge. But there are lots of niruktis on the word jhana, the meditation state, and jnana, or knowledge. So they are linked in people's minds popularly, whether etymologically or not, I'm not sure. The third one is transiency. They cannot be sustained long. Now, that's another thing I thought I'd actually try and find out. How long did people meditate for in early Buddhist texts? And they would sometimes meditate through the night, but clearly the idea of the half-hour practice isn't stated. There isn't, you know, I couldn't find a time specification of that kind. And it is possible to stay in a state for a week, but it's not really encouraged. There are some states... only enlightened beings can stay in for some of the formless meditations. You can stay in them for a week. People will think you're dead, but you won't be. But it's not really encouraged. All sorts of reasons. So, and the other thing is, in Buddhist meditation, you would review your meditation afterwards for the very aspect of impermanence. You would look at it and say that does not last. Now, the last one, actually, it is interesting to look at James. I'm glad we've had time to do that, because the last one is James identifies.
Where did he write that?
It's in The Varieties of Religious Experience, page 367. It's really the classic work on the idea of mysticism. It's Henry James's brother, William James. Two chapters, and they're the kind of, and they are wonderfully thought-provoking, you know, very, very interesting. And they've been immensely influential in Britain anyway, and in the States, I think. I don't know about it in Europe. The last one, I think, is very interesting, which is passivity. And he says it's as if his own will is in abeyance. I feel uneasy about this in a Buddhist context, and actually I suspect in many Christian contexts as well. There's something about the wording that doesn't quite feel right to me. Certainly within a Buddhist context, the meditator should always feel able to enter and leave a meditation. It's one of the techniques that are taught from the earliest texts, that no state will engulf you so that you can't leave it. And you're taught skills in emerging. And this is described in the earliest texts. the area of will, of course, is very difficult in all religious traditions. But I think if you read St. Teresa's accounts of prayer, her will is not... She's not operating selfishly, but she's in a way uniting her will with that of the Creator. That's how the texts feel, and I imagine this is the same with Sufi texts. So I think this is an area with which one needs a lot of care, and I would certainly feel it would be intrusive of me to say what other traditions are doing in that regard. Certainly in Buddhist traditions, there is a sense in which the ability to enter in and out of meditation is considered very important, and that it's not actually passive either. Jhana is very, very receptive, but it's, if you like, a kind of... The word surrender isn't used, but I think would be applicable, but from a strong basis. It's not a kind of abnegation of... Well, I suppose there is a loss of the person being described, but it's not quite the same as a self-abnegation, because the ability to enter in and out is important. I realise this is very contradictory, and that's why I'm very, very reluctant to describe other traditions in these terms, because I think it's very subtle. But the Buddhist texts say the mind should turn... What's it says? A meditator should make the mind turn according to his wish and not turn according to the mind's wish. So they're very anxious to avoid you being taken up with states that you cannot control in some way. But they don't say that you thereby become willful. You have to purify the heart. So there's a difficult balance there.
Sorry, would you mind reading that sentence?
Yes. No, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give it to you.
Is there something about mind?
Yes, I've got it on these handouts and I'll give them to you. I realise that's a slightly inconclusive conclusion, but I felt in a way that it's something I wouldn't really want to say about another tradition, but that didn't seem quite right about Buddhist meditation anyway, that there is an element of control. The last thing I wanted to say as regards mysticism, coming back to this idea of the secret... The Buddhist tradition is not usually at this stage associated with esotericism, but there are enough references, I think, to keeping secrets and confiding secrets and general care in speech that suggests that it is observed in practice if not stated. And that's to this day in Southeast Asian countries. If you're a monk and you're conducting a meditation, you could easily not know what the person in the next room is meditating upon or is meditation object. It's regarded as very, very confidential. And it's also regarded as very important from the earliest text to report constantly to your meditation teacher, who's described as a good friend, not a guru. So you report on how your practice is going and you get feedback, so that you don't make the mistake where you think you've attained something when you haven't, or that you think you've not attained something when actually you have, which is perhaps more common. But there are enough areas in the earliest Buddhist texts where I feel that this care is being exercised in the teaching and learning of meditation. And on those grounds, I would say that Buddhist meditation is mystical, perhaps more than any other, that you do need a guide and you need somebody to help you. But I think the category mysticism is a difficult one, but certainly has been a very interesting one to try and apply. So I think that's all I have to say, except I thought it would be nice to look at some but I realise you would... Should we have the response first, or look at the text, if you were going to respond?
Oh, yes, I was the Hindu response. Yes, we do that first.
Yes, whichever you like. Yeah, I sort of thought I didn't want to interfere with how things
were. I've got no pre-prepared response.
I'm
not responding as a Hindu, but drawing sort of parallels and so on. I thought it was really interesting. The immediate thing I'm struck by is the similarity with the yoga systems and the yoga sutras that you've just described.
Yes, yeah.
And even the terminology is virtually the same. Pitaka,
yes.
Vichara.
Absolutely.
Anandra instead of piti.
Mm-hmm.
Ekagrata the same.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you have samadhi in the yoga sutras is directly parallel, it seems, to jhana in the Theravada, mm-hmm. the Buddhist tradition. So I think there must be influence from yoga of Buddhist tradition there. But this idea of silence is very interesting, and also the esotericism of it. The Buddha has no closed fist in his teachings, and yet there's also a dimension of these hierarchical these practices which involve a hierarchy of levels, that there's a certain sort of secrecy or certain closedness inherent in that notion of hierarchy, it seems to me. And so there's a tension in Hinduism as well between these the idea of the openness, that particularly in, say, monistic traditions, where all reality is immediately available to you here and now, as it were, that contrasts with this notion of the withdrawal from the world and going up through different levels of refinement of consciousness, which entails a notion of a threshold and a barrier that you have to cross over, often entails a notion of initiation. That struck me in what you were saying. There was a parallelism in the Hindu traditions there, I think. I think that'll do for now.
I don't know whether you think it's a bit. Thank you. Yes, that is interesting actually, because there are so many obvious parallels, and you feel that there's a kind of common pool of terms and practices that they're drawing upon, but perhaps look at slightly differently. So perhaps if we look at these.
Yeah. I'm just thinking perhaps also that there's vipassana and samatha, the insight meditation that you mentioned, the calmness meditation, which involves the calmness and so on. And I get the impression from reading your book but others as well that there's some conflict or tension in the early tradition between those two, and I think that's parallel to in Hindu kind of traditions as well, where you have a monistic sort of worldview that what's enlightenment like? You just have, and Shankara says enlightenment is like what happens to the space inside a pot when the pot breaks, or you just have to open your eyes to the recognition that that's a snake and not a rope, or the other way around. And there's that. And then on the other hand, you've got this yogic hierarchy where you're kind of going into these levels of samadhi and so on and refining your consciousness. And that strikes me as parallel to the samatha vipassana type.
Yes, possibly. But perhaps one just needs to say that there needs to be perhaps a tension in traditions between something that goes more towards one side or the other.
There's the ehi passo, come and see, versus the idea, nirvana's over there or up there somewhere, we've got to get there, further shore.
Well, that's interesting, yes. So whether the people who are more interested by mysteries are more samatha-based and the people who are more interested by daily life and mornings. That's a very, very interesting insight, because it puzzled me. I thought about that quite a bit, and I couldn't quite assign it to any particular intellectual or philosophical tradition. And in a way, I thought, well, perhaps it's best not to. But that does seem an interesting analogy.
I lived in my life only two Zen courses, and each time I was told not to have the eyes shut. Because I was beaten up for that. and it's true when you sit there and have your eyes shut, you doze off, especially
if you do a Zen meditation, absolutely.
You have to put about 1 meter distance and have your focus at a point, but not shut, because in the moment you're shut at 5 o'clock in the morning, you go back to sleep. You doze, but you don't meditate. So, So, and somebody's watching you, you know.
Absolutely. But that's so interesting, and I was thinking of that before this talk, but I thought, well, I'll stick to Southern Buddhism. But that is so interesting, because that particular meditation is one that's much more insight, vipassana-based. And you are supposed to have, the Shobha Gensa says you should have your eyes open enough that you can see the outside world, but not too much so that you look around.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't shut them because you will become too internal. But it's interesting because that form of meditation is much more of what we were saying is an insight-based one, where you have to keep alertness. Whereas the meditation, the Samatha meditation, which I associate perhaps a little bit more with the mystical, is where you shut your eyes.
For example, mindfulness. So, it's hard work. During the time allotted to you. So.
Very hard work. But you can still work hard with your eyes shut. I mean, there is a whole world that opens up when people meditate, but it's perhaps of a different kind, very, very different kind. I mean, the underlying assumption of a mystical and of a samadhi meditation is that when by shutting the eyes, you shut off something to open something else. But that is not quite the same as a Zen practice of the kind you will have tried.
And you didn't talk about breathing?
No. No, I didn't mention breath. In fact, it is actually the practice I do, and I think I found that one of the most difficult to think about in many ways. It is the practice I write most about. The breathing meditations do can be taken one of two ways. One is to calm the mind so that the a mental image is cultivated and the mind attains jhana. And then the other one is to look at the rise and fall and the impermanence and no self of the breath and to use it as an object for insight. I should have mentioned breathing mindfulness because actually it combines both samatha and vipassana, that you can calm the mind with the breath because the breath is a very pleasant object. It will always arouse joy.
Well, you have it in all forms of meditation.
Yeah, breathing.
You know, there's two movements in and out.
Yeah. And it's very joyful as well. So that would be more on the samatha side. And the vipassana, the insight, is seeing the impermanence. It's interesting. That's the one I should have mentioned because it was combining the two. And I meant to say that at the... I got onto reading from the Samanyapala, but that is the one that combines the two, calm and insight. If you're doing an insight-based practice, like the Zen one, I think, were you by a wall? Were you looking at a wall?
I changed recently. So I'm doing this for 30 years now.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I'm not looking anymore against the wall.
Right.
I changed here. So.
Yeah.
So. But I look at one point about in the eyes, you sit there.
Yes, yeah. Well, it's just a different emphasis, the Zen one. The breathing practice will tend to be able to produce a very, very great deal of calm because it's just a very pleasant object and so it stills the mind. A great deal, and the Buddha recommends it all the time for people with any imbalances to practice.
How would you categorize this, this Tibetan meditation?
I'm talking really about the early Buddhist, the Southern Buddhist. But when you get onto Tibetan meditations, you get much more obviously mystical and esoteric elements, and it's actually built into the system. At this stage, and in Southern Buddhism, it's more implied. A very great deal of care about teaching, but it's not through ritual so much. It's not quite as ritualized. It's a different, slightly different approach.
And another question, excuse me.
That's right,
Is there this neo-Hinduism, you know, Sri Aurobindo and that sort of thing, is this a special, is there also a special type of meditation?
Is in Hinduism?
Yeah.
Neo-Hinduism.
In this modern type.
You went to Pondicherry, what would you do?
If you were doing a meditation there? Oh, right, well, I don't know. I'd have to ask Gavin.
Yeah, what's
in Hinduism.
I've never been to the Oroville there. They do different kinds of yoga, Raja yoga. Like Vivekananda had these three kinds of yoga, Raja yoga, Karma yoga, and Jnana yoga. I can't remember now. Do you remember, Peggy? Vivekananda's? I know you'll remember.
No.
We're all forgetting this afternoon.
But anyway, there are these yoga practices, but I don't think there's so much emphasis on meditation in Hinduism as there is in Buddhism. Mm.
Aurobindo's quite specific, isn't he, bringing down the super mind consciousness? It's almost like
As I ended. Sorry, I didn't catch the end of it. Yeah, I interrupted you rudely.
I was just saying Aurobindo had his own unique take on Patanjali's yoga system, in the idea that you don't just attain a level of consciousness, you actually bring down the super consciousness within you, and you become almost like a walking avatar type thing. Something that's a...
One thing I think that Hindu meditation, I think the difference would be that it's more oral, hearing based, mantra based, whereas the meditations I was saying there are actually more visual, or if you say a term, it doesn't tend to be the attribute, so it's not like a mantra, it won't contain some magical property or some divine quality. That syllable won't itself be sacred. But having said that, Southern Buddhist practice always confounds the early theory, and in fact that you go everywhere and people will think that the word Buddha has magical properties, and it is used as a mantra, really. Mm. And there are lots of modern mantric practices, and this started in Buddhism from about the 2nd century AD, so people obviously did start with mantras and dharanis very early on. But I think if I thought there was a difference, I'd say it's probably slightly more oral rather than visual, maybe, Hinduism. More chanting-based. But there's plenty of chanting in Buddhism.
Another difference I just thought of is the guru. You mentioned the spiritual friend. In some Hindu forms of meditation, you visualise the guru, your mind's eye. So I can't imagine...
No, and it's funny, you somehow wouldn't do that in a Buddhist context. It would not be quite the thing you'd do.
Yeah. In Tibetan Buddhism, you take refuge in the Buddha Dharma Sangha.
And your teacher.
So that's perhaps nearer, but you would expect that. Mm. You gave us a very rich, lovely rich range of possible understanding of what the word mysticism means, plus roots from various traditions. But in terms of, for instance, Tali mentioned last week, the sense of what one means by mysticism as a union with reality, that experience. Richly and wonderfully, what you seem to me to have been describing are the means to that union. And then when one looks at James's categories, the sort of inexpressible nature of that would to me, you'd be looking at what is said about nirvana with that idea, not just the experiences on the way. You've emphasised very much, and you might feel, well, that's where the material is in Buddhism, but you've emphasised the means
to
the experience.
No, that's a very, very good point. And I sort of, I think, because it was something that I couldn't decide, and in fact I've got these, I will give you these, because I really genuinely thought it would be interesting. As I understand it in Buddhism, there is the ineffable, and it does need to be expressed. and in that regard, it's very like the other traditions. But more commonly, Buddhism tends to stress this opener hand aspect. But nonetheless, there is a sense of the ineffable. And I've actually got some readings there, which, people might like to browse at or comment on. It's almost to see whether they really were mystical or not, or in what regard they could be called. They are different, yes. They're two pages. Yes, so you should have... Has everybody got a... have you got both? Right.
Yes.
One, two...
No, you don't have any
now. Well, you have...
Yes, I've got plenty, don't worry. We've got plenty here. I'm just trying to get a two and a one. There we are.
I
want to ask you, if now when we look at these, and I'm sure all the other examples of accounts of mystical experience, we will see that this ineffability is not really, doesn't really stand for them. I mean, you can really talk about religious experiences, and there is actually something you can say about and about such states. And in one conversation with one psychologist, she told me that we cannot talk about them because we don't have a vocabulary to talk about them. So I was thinking, when you said that you were checking your states with your meditation teacher, how do you talk about these experiences? How do you describe to your teacher what is going on? I mean, how do you, what words do you exactly use? Is there some, you know, are there some standardized words, or you just describe the picture you have seen?
You just literally describe how you've seen it. Uh-huh. And they say specifically when you should see a teacher is when the nimitta arises, the mental image, because that's a product of samatha practice. And you actually go to your teacher and you do just literally say what you have seen. And it's a question people often ask. They sort of say, well, how can I describe my meditation? And then they start to describe it, and they do.
Yes.
Actually, the nearest analogy I think is if you often talk to people about their research, and they say, but I don't know how to describe my research, and then and they explain it, and they've just explained it to you very well.
Yes.
But they say, but I don't know how to describe it. And you say, but that's fine. Yeah. And it's almost like, it obviously these things are ineffable, just like your doctoral
the
research.
But feelings
are ineffable. Yes. But actually, when people are talking, we look at their body language and everything, and actually you do understand what they're saying, and you build up a shared vocabulary, and I'm sure that is the case in Buddhist practitioners will build up a shared vocabulary of how they describe things like joy. We'd call it piti, and it might be called nanda or something.
Yes, or maybe you have 10 words for joy.
Yeah,
like Eskimos have
snow,
right?
Exactly,
And you will be able to distinguish between different varieties of joy.
Absolutely, what a wonderful point. Yes, we should have more vocabulary.
Yes, and then you would be able to talk more.
That's wonderful.
I'm not sure if you use the vocabulary. You know, I had to, for example, I had to clean the public toilet with my toothbrush in Tibetan meditation. Or I had to clean outside the teacher, you know, in a hurtful position for 2 hours.
Oh, gosh.
But he lets you wait, you know, to harm you, know, which is, he knows it exactly, but, you know, he brings you to a certain state of mind. So when you come in, you know, you're just boiling, you know, you're just mad like hell. But he knows you. He knows that, of course.
Gosh, that's very brave of you to go on the I'm very impressed.
So would you then say that this rage or this anger that you have felt is a part of, was that a mystical experience for you?
No, for example, when they treat you badly, you know, it's just that if it doesn't hurt, it's not worth it. They ask you, for example, are you sick? You know, after laying you out in the corridor, and then you say yes, and he says, well, just don't care if you're sick or healthy, let's get rid of this crap, you know. So the state, if you're sick or not sick, he thinks it's, you know, it's like a scratch, you know, you should go to more important things. So, you know, they're provocating, and they know it.
But it's arousing energy. They would say that it's arousing sangvega energy, so that when you come to sit in meditation, you will have a lot to transform, alchemical process of transform. Your anger will be so great, it will, when it comes to peace, it will change
a lot of
a great
books,
deal.
Novels by Americans who went to, you know, to Kyoto and left the Sato. So they come back, made like hell. And I think you can. But how can you, the question is these things, how much can you really teach in a sort of detached academic, you know, scientific way? Now you read 20 books.
You can't.
Like when you talk about French food, you know, do you read the menus and the recipes and the cookbooks about French food, but never eat French food.
No, I quite agree. That's why I couldn't. I agree. But you have to remember we're in English universities where you have to. We're in an English university where you have to, don't you? You have to describe.
Degrees in meditation. Degrees in meditation.
Psychic power exams on outside. Harry Potter's sort of things.
Well, we have a long tradition of the Potter type in Oxford.
Yes, so you have some questions.
I wanted really to say something about the idea of ineffability. I'm sure the idea that, you know, there are areas where we, either as a community or as individuals, just don't have the vocabulary. Me and music, for example. Other people can talk about music in particular ways, and I don't have that vocabulary. This is fine. Also, your point about chewing on a fresh apple. It's not trivial to say that this experience has certain unique qualities which... Yes, I mean, that smile on your face might say something about, but it doesn't do justice to. But I wonder if with meditation, besides that, perhaps there's an additional kind of point that when we talk about apples or music or whatever, the sheer point about talking about them means you have to put them into categories. And maybe one of the reasons why many people have felt that experiences of association with God, whatever it is ineffable, because the mere fact of trying to categorize seems to be doing violence crucial that you experienced. So it's not that, not the little bit of this and that, sure, but maybe it's violating something much more central than when you're talking about music.
I think that's a really good point, and there's an interesting distinction in Buddhism between people who teach by silence and the Buddha who does formulate. So clearly the act of compassion is associated with this need to go into the world of categories, which, as you say, is not true. I mean, So, but maybe, while there is a truth, that these Pacheka Buddhas that pop up all the time in Buddhism, they just teach through silence and riddles and things. But they're not as compassionate as the Buddha who teaches through using categories.
He does also be silent and also holds up a flower.
Yes, there's the flower.
Yes, one of the traditions about the origins of Zen Buddhism is when the Buddha himself, instead of giving a sermon speech, he holds up a flower.
A flower.
And one offers the Mahakasa that smiles. That's the transmission. So there is a bit of that as well, isn't there, in the story about him.
But I think that there's a very, very interesting questions, because how can you write academically about mystical experience in one sense? But wouldn't it be boring if you didn't? Obviously, it's completely wrong. But
you can write about the stories, not about experiences. This is what we can do.
We might be able to indicate something about the experiences. It's
more about evocation of the experience. You know. There is a purpose. Why do you want to say experience? You know, this is always important. And when you tell about, for example, chewing an apple, then when you hear this, you will evoke your experience about chewing an apple, and you will probably have, on the other side of the communication channel, certain feelings that are much more than what your interlocutor said. So
what do you think? I mean, poetry, for instance, is obviously... So on page 2 of here, I put some little poems. I mean, they're not as developed as koans or... These are little poems by monks who've just become enlightened.
This is number 5, isn't it?
5, yes. And I thought, well, I wouldn't say they're mystical, but I wouldn't say they're not mystical either. They're just little poems, people.
It's got a
Isn't it? Mm. Small hut is not really.
So is that mystical writing?
It's all sort of nature.
Yeah. It's more like a haiku.
It's like an Indian haiku. Oh,
yeah. Yes, yeah. It is, exactly, yeah. But it's evocation through a kind of symbol or a metaphor, isn't it? So I suppose it's mystical.
Well, putting some consciousness to rather than looking at the sphere which is created through those two observations.
Yes,
But there's a, because you talked about music, there's now a book, I forgot the title, but I have it, I have not read it. Neuroscientist.
I mentioned it.
A doctor. He analyzed the brain and the electricity, who also likes music. What exactly happens with your brain when you listen to music which you go visit or like, hate, or whatever? But the musical experience, which you cannot put in words, you know, what happens in your brain exactly? And from there he wrote a book about music, how you process music, basically. So
I think it's been done with people in meditative states, hasn't it, in the United States of America. They've actually attached electrodes to people. And
there are changes, aren't there?
Yeah, monitored that there are changes in certain areas of the brain. But I don't know quite what that... What does that demonstrate?
Exactly.
And when you go there, it's not approved, but, just you don't meditate, you just collect experience.
So would this be something that a disciple would tell to a teacher?
It would be after enlightenment that these verses they come up with, these ecstatic. And I just thought I'd just have a look round some Buddhist texts and see. Really, I was actually quite curious because I don't feel, I don't know myself what mystical really is, in a way. And I thought I'd be curious as to see how far, I mean, after the enlightenment, the first one, the Buddha didn't want to teach, and then he is persuaded to. So in a way, that's a statement of ineffability, isn't it? That's where I was thinking on the lines you were asking about, was in, and then at the beginning... Now, Richard Gombrich, this is the only, said in his book, this is the only place where the Buddha really stresses how difficult the teaching is. It's the beginning of the Mahanidana Sutra, it's the bottom of page one. And Ananda says, isn't it wonderful? Everything's so clear and wonderful. He's a great faith. The Buddha says, no, it's not easy to see. It's very difficult to see, very deep, and one is considered a refutation of the other, but in a way I sort of feel they're both right. Really, it's like in that both represent a rightness. And the you sort of say, well, that's obvious, that's wonderful, but of course it isn't as well.
But maybe this whole business about it's either X or Y is a very particular kind of logic.
Yes, that's a very good point. But yeah.
It's also the sense that it's there in one of the Zen poems, isn't it? That you have an awareness and then you continue to practice and revisit and the awareness is different and then you keep, as it were, focusing on that and the awareness keeps changing and then you might get back to the point very close, you know, it's like when mountains are in mountains. You begin to see something else, but then every time you revisit the object or experience, or maybe those overlapping, there is a change. But then at some point you might come back to where you were right at the beginning, but it's a different kind of statement and awareness you have in the same words, as it were.
Yes, maybe that's right, yeah. Yeah. You get back to the same point. Yes. Anyway, I like that because that, as you say, was just the little conversation was a statement of ineffability of something.
So maybe Ananda does see. Maybe how many years, when he eventually is enlightened, he'll see again.
Yes, exactly. Like real philosophy, you're stepping in the same river and not in the same river at the same time.
Well, that's encouraging for people, isn't it? That's our beginning meditation.
Yes, I mean, that's why I put that in, because I thought, well, that's actually a wonderful sort of statement of
the ineffable that isn't ineffable, but sort of is. Yeah. And then there's a more classic ineffable kind of statement on page 2 about there is monks that sphere where there is no earth, no water, no fire, no air. Now, this is the sort of nature. This is on page 3 near the bottom. And this is the description of Nirvana. And that, I think, comes under the sort of heading you would describe, Peggy, as is page 2 towards the... I thought these would be nice to browse over, just to sort of speculate as to whether one felt they were mystical. And that one, I think, that's just mystical language, isn't it? And you can't quite say why, but it's...
And I like the earth is sprinkled, very much number 5. Do you think that's snow or spring flower? What's it sprinkled?
Rain?
Yes.
Gentle rain.
Wouldn't you call this just, like you said, a mystical statement, not experience, since experience is always connected in with an event? Or with a particular moment that something.
Well, the Buddha is saying that, so he is saying it exists. So presumably, it's connected to his own experience. But that's somebody. When I was talking to somebody last week about this, they said, "Well, mystical experience, you have to have the first person. You know, that has to be it was me kind of thing." And that's why I chose the. And there's a nice little verse here by a female beggar who becomes a nun for all the wrong reasons. But she still gets enlightened. She's a beggar, burnt by heat and cold, wandered for 7 years. Then she sees a nun and she trusts her. Please accept me in your order. So she really just does it for food and drink. She gets, but maybe there's another kind of food and drink she wanted. And then she's enlightened. And I thought, that's just a very nice first person.
It's very rare in the Indian traditions. This kind of first person account.
Isn't it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's a very good point. That as itself, it's not a natural mode, is it? Mm. No, that's a
is
very
that right?
I mean, you often think of India as mysticism and all that, but actually, there's hardly any text that are in the.
What did I do?
In the personal voice.
That's a very, very
Sorry, would there be. There must be accounts of this.
You look at the Shankara, often gets thought of as a mystic, but there's hardly. He talks about Anubhava experience sometimes, but there's hardly anything of his experience in the.
So it's not that there are. So it's not that there are experiences or reports, but expressed in different kinds of ways, i.e., instead of I. We or one or some other word like
third person accounts. Or what should be the case, or systematized into a system.
Yes, people don't use the word. It's partly a good thing. When I say it's partly a good thing, it's partly the thing that they don't want to colour observations with I to sort of make the sense of self in there. But I suppose it does lack the sense that I grew up in such and such a context. But they might think that was a very selfish kind of consideration to talk about yourself in that way.
You get colophons at the end of a great long commentary that I'm a butcher, and I've achieved this highest state.
Yeah. Experience is not enough. You need a peak experience.
Yes.
do you? So they put autobiographies and colophons?
Yeah.
That's interesting. But King Ashoka's descriptions, you see, that's why I find them so moving. Because there are a lot of them are in the first person. I'm very remorseful for all the terrible things I did. But very often, when he talks about Kalinga, he tends to use the third person. There was the king performed terrible deeds and massacred. But he doesn't say I.
I did.
And then
my
when
dad.
Yes, the king. but when he, I think that's the case. I will have to check that more. But when he talks about the first person, he says, "I have tried to make up for these terrible things."
Because that's it's like himself in a former life, really, when he was a baddie and now he's a goodie. So
yeah, he changes it. Yeah. Yes, yes, but they are. They're quite moving. Those.
And I have always wondered about these third-person accounts. How could they know? about how this person felt or acted if they weren't told by this person. So I guess it's because of the humility and not wanting to show off and to bullshit your own experience.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. But also the real, if it was a bestseller, I was just thinking in 3rd century BC it'd be a Vanksa story, because there's all those Vanksa, Chula Vanksa, Tupa Vanksa, the family, the lineage, that if you were to, they don't read biographies or autobiographies, but they just read Vanksa's, these are lineage descriptions of the lineage, so that the description of a whole lineage of Buddhas back in the beginning of time, of stupas going back in the beginning of time, they describe all the different sort of jewels in the necklace, because they want, it's more important to be part of a family than to be an individual. Well, so that it's much more interesting to write a family saga than a me saga.
Yeah, but also, I mean, you mentioned Yeats last week. I mean, there's some suggestions that, you know, Indian culture, I mean, this has to be a gross oversimplification, is just much less individualistic than, quote, the West, and that when you describe themselves, they use much fewer individualistic concepts, and they're much more relational and to do with families and so on.
Yes,
and
that's
that
right.
Play into these descriptions of these sorts of things.
I think so. Yeah.
Maybe this lineage.
I'm just thinking of, you know, in the Bhagavad Gita, I suppose that chapter 11, mystical experience Arjuna has. You have this also in it. I mean, it's told by Sanjaya, who tells the story, so he has a mystical ability to be even to be able to see what's happening. So you're the reader, you're sort of one level of entering the discourse to be told by Sanjaya, and then Sanjaya is recounting what happens to what Krishna says to Arjuna. You know? So Arjuna is recounting his mystical experience.
Oh, right.
Yes. Sort of as the reader.
Yeah.
And I suppose traditionally the Bhagavad Gita was recited, I suppose, by the teacher or in katas. So that's another layer. So it's sort of access to the one who has access to the one who has access to the one who has. It's this sort of chain.
That's a wonderfully interesting point. It's just the same in Buddhist suttas, where you have people, third person description of a first person description recounted to somebody else. Just the same thing.
Story instead of story.
Which makes me think also about the many ways of layers of discussing mystical experience or mysticism. In one sense, it's like some of those are evocative of the mystical experience, and like those poems, but very much depending on the one who is approaching the discussion. And so yes, there's an academic discourse looking at the textual phenomenon of mysticism. That's one layer, and then you have those who practice but are also academics. And so there's this shared experience where you can use terminology and language, and people recognize that. And then there's purely practitioners who are perhaps not so interested in the academic discourse, but more in the experience. Like you have the teacher, and you're going to the teacher, and it's not so much a shared academic discussion, but just in the experience. So there's,
layers and layers.
There's different levels.
Levels, that's a better word, isn't it?
Yeah.
Levels. No, I agree. I think that's a very interesting point. All the different kinds of stories and ways you can
Thank you, sir. I think we have to wind up.
Thank you.
Next time we have George Patterson, who's going to speak to us about apophaticism, which means inevitability.